We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the United Nations, and very specifically, we'll be talking about the UN Security Council. The Security Council has 15 members. Five of them are permanent and have a veto power. Those are China, France, Russia, the UK, and the United States. Arguably, this body is the most powerful diplomatic body in the world, and when the members, particularly the permanent members, are in agreement, there are almost no limits to its authority. At the same time, the member states do have their own interests, and at times those interests have been in conflict, some would say, with the interests of the rest of the world. How can we evaluate the effectiveness of this body? What can it do and cannot do, and what does it do? Those are the questions we'll take up this morning in this hour of the show as we talk with David Bosco. He is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University and is the author of a book that is about the UN Security Council and the making of the modern world. The title of his book is Five to Rule Them All, and that, of course, refers to the five permanent members. His book is published by the Oxford University Press and takes a look at the history of the Security Council over time. And if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Our guest is a former senior editor at Foreign Policy. He's also been a political analyst and journalist. His writings have appeared in a number of places, including Washington Post, Slate, the New York Times Book Review, the LA Times, Wall Street Journal, and other places. He has also provided commentary and analysis for CNN, for National Public Radio, for Voice of America, other outlets. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, your questions are welcome. We ask people, however, just to be brief in your questions and comments. We ask that so we can keep moving, get as many callers in as possible. But questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you are certainly welcome to call. Professor Bosco, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am fine. And yourself?
Good, thank you.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. I know this was a book that you worked on for quite a long time, for several years.
Yes.
What was it particularly about the Security Council that interested you so much that you wanted to make a major project out of this?
Right. I did spend the last 3 years, a little more than 3 years, researching and writing the book. And I think some of the things that you highlighted in your introductory comment were what really interested me in the project. The UN Security Council, if you just look at the United Nations Charter, which is arguably the most important international treaty out there, the UN Security Council has huge amounts of power. If it can agree, and that's obviously a big question, it can do things like impose blockades on countries, impose sanctions. It can use force. It really can wage war in the name of the international community. And so, you know, if you look at the Security Council from the perspective of international history, it's really an amazing diplomatic creation. It's amazing that this body, this small body, got so much power and so much authority. And so from my kind of legal background, and I'm a lawyer by training, that was very interesting to me. And then I think maybe the journalistic side in me wanted to kind of tell the story of this body. You know, what happens when you put ambassadors from some of the most powerful countries in the world together and ask them to maintain international peace and security? What happens in that room? And so that's how I ended up pursuing this project. I really wanted to kind of tell the story of the UN Security Council. And in the course of doing the research, I interviewed, you know, 50 or 60 former ambassadors who had served on the council, as well as looked into the memoirs and, you know, archival documents from other ambassadors to try to get a sense of, you know, of what it's been like in that room, and also to talk more broadly about the value of the institution.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that I'm sure we'll talk about in some detail. Maybe to deal with that a little bit here up front, I think that many people find the United Nations frustrating because
yeah.
they say The world is confronted with a number of very serious problems, and you would think that an international body like the UN would be in a position to really take those problems on. And I think many people feel that when you look at some of the biggest kind of problems the world faces, that the UN hasn't been very successful. Mm-hmm. I think you make an interesting and different kind of an argument that if you are trying to ask this question, how effective is the United Nations? You have to be perhaps more realistic about what it can do, and then also, you know, how one measures that effectiveness.
Yeah, I think first of all, I agree with you that there's a lot of frustration about the United Nations, and actually, I think it's particularly strong in the United States. I think there's always been a current of thought in the United States that's very skeptical of the UN. But I think there are good reasons to be skeptical. If we look at the array of international problems out there, from nuclear proliferation to crimes against humanity and genocide, terrorism, the trafficking in small arms, and all that kind of stuff, the Security Council, I think, has been very, you know, really mediocre at best, and I think that's really being generous. In terms of solving those problems. And you can take any number of examples. You know, India and Pakistan developed nuclear weapons in the last 15 years. The Security Council protested in both cases, but wasn't able to do anything about it. Now we see that North Korea has developed nuclear weapons. Iran may be on its way to doing so. And the council's kind of divided about how to respond. And then you have things like genocide in Rwanda in the 1990s, the atrocities in Darfur that are still going on. So from the perspective of solving that kind of problem, I think the Security Council is not very good. But what I do argue in the book is that it does something important, which is that it gets together the most powerful or some of the most powerful countries in the world and forces them to talk and negotiate and compromise on a daily basis. It really is, if you look at the history of international relations, it's an amazing thing that every day up in New York, you have senior representatives from China, Russia, the United States, the UK, and France sitting down and trying to negotiate their way through issues. And that, I think, is a valuable thing on its own, even if we acknowledge that the Security Council hasn't been very good at solving these broader problems out there. It does create this dialogue and something like a habit of compromise between the major powers. And that, I think, is a very valuable thing. And I point out in the book, I tell the story of some of the crises the Security Council has been involved in and try to show how having this forum where the major powers sit down together has been useful and in some cases may have helped us avert, you know, possible crises or even confrontation between the major powers.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Bosco. He's the author of the book Five to Rule Them All. It's about the UN Security Council, how it came to be, how it functions. His subtitle is The Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. Our guest is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are indeed welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The Security Council, the idea of the Security Council goes back a long way, right to the very founding of the institution of the United Nations. And for good or ill, I suppose, you have to say that the victorious powers, the Allies, coming out of World War II, Britain, the United States, and Russia, mm-hmm. represented by Churchill, FDR, and Stalin, got together, and they were thinking about what the world was going to be like from that point forward. Their interest was to have a very strong voice, perhaps the strongest voices in the United Nations. So that's where we come up with this idea that there would be a Security Council and that there would be permanent members and that Russia, the UK, and the United States mm-hmm. would be among them.
Yes. That was it's a really interesting period of history because World War II hadn't even ended when the major Allied powers started talking about what kind of structure are we going to have for the, you know, post-war period. And they all, right from the beginning, agreed that, okay, yes, we'll have some kind of universal organization, but it needs to have a special place for the great powers. You need a special club, in essence, and the great powers should have special powers and special responsibilities that the rest of the membership doesn't have. So they were all agreed on that right from the beginning. And it's one of the interesting features of the founding of the United Nations that basically the draft of the UN, what became the United Nations Charter, was written by a very small group of the leading powers, as you mentioned, the United States, the UK, and the Soviet Union. Now, one of the interesting stories that I tell in the book is how it was that we got from those three to what we now know as the permanent five members of the Security Council. And it's an interesting story. Churchill insisted that the French be included as one of the great powers, as one of the permanent five, and Roosevelt and Stalin were kind of perplexed by this because, you know, France had been occupied during the war. Stalin said that after the war, France would no longer be a great power. He said it would be charming but weak. And, you know, so they didn't understand why Churchill wanted to include France. But he wanted to because he wanted another great power on the European continent. He realized that Britain wasn't going to have the manpower or the resources to keep an army on the continent, and he wanted to kind of resuscitate France. So that was how he got France there. And when you look at, you know, China and why China's there, you have to thank Franklin Roosevelt because he insisted, you know, and finally persuaded Stalin and Churchill that China should be included. And so that was all agreed on at a conference in the closing days of World War II. And so... But that's why you hear this complaint often about the Security Council, that it's antiquated, it's the product of, you know, world politics at the end of World War II and not a product of the way the world is now. But it's been amazing how stable and how this institution has endured.
And when you talk about China, I suppose we should remind people that what we were talking about at the time was not the People's Republic of China. We were talking about nationalist China. So this was the Taiwan government, and the change to from them occupying that seat to the PRC occupying that seat, that didn't come until the 1970s.
That's a very good point. And also one of the strange features of the Security Council was that, you know, even after the government of Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist Chinese, lost power and they fled to Taiwan, they still held the Security Council seat, as you say, all the way through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, until finally the UN membership voted to replace them with the communist Chinese. And so that was a very strange feature of Security Council diplomacy. And some people think that it actually hampered the Security Council quite significantly because, you know, the presidency of the Security Council rotates every month, and when it would come Taiwan's turn to serve as the president, it would be a strange period because a lot of other countries on the Security Council didn't recognize Taiwan as the government of China. And so often you wouldn't have Security Council meetings during that period, during that month, or they'd be very brief meetings because it was just awkward for countries to interact with a government that they didn't recognize.
Another interesting part to this story is that there is one other country that came close to being one of the permanent members. Again, I think people might be surprised. I didn't know this little aspect of history.
Yeah.
Franklin Roosevelt really wanted Brazil to be a member.
Yeah, he did. And he had to try to persuade even some of his advisors, because a lot of his advisors thought this was kind of a crazy idea. But Roosevelt was very conscious that of maintaining good relations with Latin America, and his feeling was that Latin America should have some kind of permanent representative on the council. And Brazil seemed like the natural choice because they, you know, are the largest. They had some troops fighting in the Allied effort in World War II. And Argentina, of course, had a strange relationship with the Axis powers, so that made Argentina kind of out of the running. So he pushed for Brazil, but he could not persuade Churchill and Stalin on this point because they thought basically Brazil would just be a vote with the United States. And it'd almost be like a proxy vote for the U.S., and so they wouldn't budge on that.
And that's, I guess, another thing about that I think that's interesting is that now today, as we're talking about, some people think that there should be an enlargement of the Security Council and that it should have more permanent members.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later, but I think that that in that conversation, some people would argue, yes, in fact, if we were going to add more permanent members, that Brazil ought to be one of them.
Oh, I'm
sure that President Lula da Silva would say, yeah, yes, sure, that'd be a great idea.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot. I'm sure there's a lot of frustration in Brazil that they came as close as they did, and because now, as you say, they're waging a diplomatic battle to try to get on the Security Council in a permanent seat, and it's a very hard thing to do.
So, when the rest of the world came together to found the United Nations, there must have been some of the countries saying, "Why should the Security Council have all this power? Yeah. Why should particularly their five permanent members have the power of veto? Why? And of course, as we know, the great powers won. How did that get battled out?
Yeah, and it really was a battle. They called together, of course, it was in San Francisco that they called together this major international conference to, you know, formalize the agreement on the United Nations. And of course, when every delegation arrived in San Francisco, they were handed a copy of the draft that the Allied powers had come up with on their own. And so, you know, they were handed this draft. They read these provisions on the Security Council, and they said, my God, I mean, this body has so much power. It can do all these things, including wage war, all in the name of the international community. And the great powers have a veto. So they basically can immunize themselves from anything. So there was actually almost like a rebellion at San Francisco when some of the smaller powers tried to restrain or modify the powers of the Security Council, and it was actually led by an Australian. The Australian delegation was very active in trying to modify some of the powers of the Security Council, and the great powers, what would become the permanent five, were outraged at the Australians, and at one point they actually summoned the Australian ambassador up to the penthouse suite where the permanent five were working from in the hotel, and they said, look, you got to stop this. You know, either you stop all this agitating against the Security Council or there won't be a United Nations. That was basically how they presented it to him. They said, you know, we've agreed amongst ourselves that we need these powers, we need the veto and everything, and so either you accept it or there's no organization. And that was hard. That was a hard thing to respond to, and so the smaller powers, even the ones most skeptical, finally signed on because they wanted an organization, and they were willing to accept what they considered the excessive powers of the Security Council in order to get it.
Our guest in this hour, David Bosco, he is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School, so his training is in law. He's also been a political analyst and a journalist, and he is author of the recent book that looks at the history of the UN Security Council. The title of his book is Five to Rule Them All. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Naperville, and that's our toll free line. Line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I think the UN is an inept organization. I think they need to move out of New York and be somewhere else because, quite frankly, they don't do anything. I kind of think it's like a gentleman's club in there. I mean, basically, you know, the people in there don't do much. I mean, there's a lot of talk, but they don't walk the walk. At least that's in my perspective. I think they're supposed to be there for a reason. But I think it's all been lost in the last couple of decades because it seems to me they have a chance to correct a lot of problems or at least put some force or some bite into it on issues around the world, and it never happens. So, you know, and I don't understand why we're spending all this time and money with these people in the first place. I mean, I'm a firm believer that maybe we should be in isolationism now, because we've got an economy that's gone awry, and it seems like there's no priorities and stuff anymore. So,
well, let's get a comment. I guess the caller, we've talked a little bit earlier about, you know, how people feel about the UN and its ability to solve problems. I think the caller really states the view I expect probably of a lot of people.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with the caller in all respects, even though I disagree with his conclusion. I agree with him that the organization is often inept. And in the book, I try not to, you know, disguise that at all. And I tell the story, for example, of what happened in the mid-1990s during the Rwandan genocide, when you had UN peacekeepers who'd been sent by the UN on the ground in Rwanda. They were there trying to monitor a ceasefire agreement. The genocide starts, and, you know, 800,000 people are killed within the space of a couple of months, and the Security Council cannot get its act together to do anything about it. In fact, they actually reduce the number of peacekeepers in the country. And all the while, Rwanda, the government, basically the government committing the genocide, has a seat on the UN Security Council. So it's privy to all of the negotiations and conversations that are going on within the Security Council. So, you know, examples like that lend a lot of support to the idea that this organization is hopeless, that it's inept. But I would, you know, ultimately disagree with the caller, because I do think, you know, he says, you know, it talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. And I think the talk is actually important, and that it's an important feature of international diplomacy. And I would just give a couple of examples. Back in 1948, so early on in the UN's history, there was this the Berlin blockade, which was a very dangerous period where the U.S. and the Soviets were kind of nose-to-nose over Berlin. And the way that that crisis ultimately got resolved was through a quiet conversation between the American ambassador and the Soviet ambassador just outside of a Security Council meeting. And over the next couple months, they had another series of meetings where they helped pull the superpowers out of this confrontation. And you see other examples like that. In the 1967 Middle East War, the 1973 Middle East War, the superpowers used the Security Council and Security Council resolutions to help kind of pull themselves out of that crisis and make sure that they didn't get dragged into it. So these are important instances of the organization, the Security Council in particular, being useful in resolving crises. But I might disagree with the caller also, you know, in another respect. I traveled with the Security Council to Eastern Congo and to the Darfur region of Sudan as part of my research for the book. And in those places, which are some of the kind of worst places in the world, in a sense where you have atrocities going on, you know, the United Nations is on a daily basis delivering food, protecting refugees, delivering humanitarian aid. Now, there are lots of ways in which they fall short, and they certainly don't have the resources that they need. But it's hard to walk through a camp full of refugees, all of whom are fed by the United Nations, protected by the United Nations, and say that the United Nations is useless or that it doesn't do anything. Because for a lot of people around the world, particularly people in very, very desperate situations, the United Nations does do some things. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And it's not fair to simply say that the organization is useless. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you make some other points, and this might be an odd way of saying this is a positive thing about the Security Council, but the wheels grind very slowly.
Yeah.
And that, again, must be, I'm sure, is a source of frustration for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But in cases where we have conflicts between great powers, and during the Cold War, this certainly was the case, that the fact that the Council does delay and does put things off, and it just takes them, it seems to take them forever to do anything, that's actually a positive thing.
Yeah, and I think if you wanted to point to an episode where that you can see the virtue of delay, you might point to the Cuban Missile Crisis, actually, where you know, during those very tense weeks, there were a series of Security Council meetings on the subject. Now, nothing came out of those Security Council meetings. There was no resolution. There was no action by the Security Council, and that was because the U.S. was on one side and the Soviets were on the other, and they both had the veto power. But that process of arguing and talking up in New York may have helped slow down the pace of the crisis. And in the book, I quote Dean Rusk, who was President Kennedy's Secretary of State at the time, and he says that the United Nations earned its pay for a long time to come during the Cuban Missile Crisis just by being there, and as you say, providing a place to slow down the pace of events. He thinks the United Nations made it less likely that one of the countries involved in that crisis would take rash action. So, you know, it's hard to – I understand the frustration of the caller, and it's certainly shared by a lot of people. But it's hard to put a value on that kind of thing. And, you know, I think that the value of helping the great powers navigate their way through crises is really very high, and, mm-hmm. and we shouldn't kind of dismiss it.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, we're talking about the United Nations Security Council, something about how it came to be and how it operates, the subject of the book Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World, by our guest David Bosco. He is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. One of the this might seem to be a small thing, but I think, it's sort of an interesting little piece of the story. One of the things that people had to figure out when the council was being organized and when the whole operation was being set up was, well, okay, where are we going to meet?
Yeah.
What's the place going to look like? And I'm looking here at a photograph of the place where the Security Council chamber. And it's interesting in a couple of respects. First of all, in that it almost looks a little bit like a concert hall. We have this big area of seating for the public,
yeah.
and then there's something that looks kind of like a stage. And then on the stage is the table, which is shaped like a horseshoe where the members sit. And that was a very conscious decision because someone decided, well, if we're going to get down to brass tacks and have these heated discussions and debates, and people are going to be, we hope, reasoning with one another, they need to look at each other.
Yeah.
So they fixed it so that people could look at each other. And yet it looks like a stage, and that perhaps it says something about the fact that over time, it has been a setting for a political theater.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's true that architecture is a really interesting aspect of the design of the places that the Security Council has met. And I was able to uncover in the course of researching the book that, you know, notes and conversations between the architects about what the Security Council chamber should look like. And as you say, the design of the table, which is kind of circular, was very conscious because they wanted the ambassadors to be looking at each other and not to be looking out at the public or looking at the cameras. But, of course, this Security Council chamber has a public gallery. It's got cameras all over the place. In fact, many of the early meetings of the Security Council were televised live on national television, which is something that I think it's easy to forget nowadays how much attention the Security Council got in its early days. But there are these two competing aspects of the Security Council's work. It is public theater. You know, it's a place, particularly in the Council's early days, it was a place for the superpowers to yell at each other and, you know, try to skewer each other with clever speeches. But it's also a place where the ambassadors try to work things out quietly. And one of the little-known aspects of the Security Council is that where it does most of its work these days is not in that formal chamber with the public gallery, but it's actually a small little conference room a couple of steps away where the Council meets on a daily basis. And there are no cameras, there's no transcript of the meetings, there's no public there. It's just a private space for them to negotiate between themselves. And that conference room was built in the late 1970s, and some of the ambassadors that I talked to think that it was a very important development because it allowed them to move away from the glare of the television lights and just talk to each other as one professional to another. And there's a story I tell in the book. I was interviewing a former American ambassador who was there when this conference room was built, and he said that in one of the first times that they met in there, you know, away from the public, that you know, all the ambassadors came in, including the Soviet ambassador and one of the Soviet allies. I think it was Bulgaria at the time. They had one of the rotating seats on the council, and the Bulgarian ambassador started to go into a huge propaganda-like denunciation of the United States and imperialism. You know, it was like any kind of classic Cold War speech. And the Soviet ambassador, you know, this guy's ally, listened for a minute, and then he leaned over to him and in perfect English said to him, you know, Mr. Ambassador, we don't speak that way in this room. This room is for, you know, quiet, respectful conversation between diplomats. You can save that kind of speech for the formal chamber. And that, I think, it kind of symbolizes the value of meeting in private. But it also makes people angry because particularly countries not on the Security Council, they don't like the fact that the Security Council can just go behind closed doors and negotiate. And it makes them angry and nervous that, you know, what's going on in there, we should have access to it. So there's this push and pull in the Security Council's history between private deliberations and public ones.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back for a second, I think it's notable, as you said, that early on, the activities of the council got a lot of attention, and as you said, some of the sessions were actually televised live.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now today, the only time that's going to happen is if something really big is going on, and I suppose that means something really big as far as the United States government or other governments would consider it to be really big.
Yeah.
And that it just doesn't get that level of attention. But again, as you say, the council actually meets every day.
Almost every day.
Almost every day.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think part of the reason it got so much attention early on and it was televised live, a couple of things. First, the public was intensely interested in the United Nations because this was supposed to be the solution to world politics. This was supposed to be the solution to conflict. And so people around the world, but including in the United States, were fascinated by what was going on. And the other thing that I think got it so much public attention was that you never knew what was going to happen at these meetings. They weren't scripted meetings. There was room for spontaneity, for unexpected clashes, and so, you know, you'd have ambassadors kind of yelling at each other, and that made for fairly good television. And of course, you know, you see this at certain moments. The real use of the council as public theater, probably the most famous moment is during the Cuban Missile Crisis when Adlai Stevenson kind of confronts the Soviet ambassador. And actually, when he did that, it was all ad-libbed. He basically said, you know, Mr. Ambassador, do you have missiles in Cuba? I'll wait here until hell freezes over for your answer. That was great television. You know, nobody knew exactly what was going to happen during that meeting. Today, the way the Security Council operates, basically, everyone knows what's going to happen when it meets in its formal sessions because everything's already been negotiated behind the scenes.
I think there's a good story connected with that particular moment. This obviously was a point where there was a great tension between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the Kennedy administration was consumed with how best to deal with that, and they knew that the ambassador was going to go there and he was going to give this speech. And there was apparently a constant sort of back and forth between the Kennedy administration, between this people and the ambassador. And it got to the point where he was on his way to the United Nations, and the Kennedy people were calling him.
Yeah.
We're trying to say, look, we want you to do this. We want you to say this. And it got to the point where he said, I'm not even going to take the president's call anymore.
That's
or
right.
Their call anymore, which I'm sure infuriated the Kennedy people. And then when it came down to it, that no one fed him that now famous line. That apparently was his, and he just... Who knows at what point he came up with it, but that was a fairly spontaneous kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a really interesting. I try to tell the story behind the scenes of that Adlai Stevenson moment in the Security Council, because, as you say, there was all this back and forth between the White House and Stevenson about how exactly to conduct himself in the Security Council, how aggressive to be with the Soviets, you know, how much to challenge them, and. Yeah, he was very frustrated because Washington kept phoning him and saying, take out this paragraph, you know, add in this paragraph. And he finally walked off at a certain point and said, look, I'm going to do it. And his aides were kind of chasing behind him saying, the president's trying to reach you. And they finally got him to take the president's call at a phone booth right outside of the Security Council chamber.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another interesting element to that story, which is that Adlai Stevenson had to be really convinced by the CIA to make the case about the missiles in Cuba, because Stevenson had been very embarrassed a few months earlier during the Bay of Pigs episode, when the CIA had given him photographs that purported to show that the United States wasn't involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion. And Stevenson had held those photos up at the United Nations, and then a few days later it became apparent that the U.S. was deeply involved. And Stevenson actually almost resigned over that incident. And so when a few months later the Cuban Missile Crisis arises and the CIA sends up someone to New York to brief Adlai Stevenson and explain to him the evidence, Stevenson apparently greeted that briefer very coldly and said, you better be prepared to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that you're right. Because he was, you know, he was by that point very skeptical of the intelligence community, which is interesting because, of course, that connects to Colin Powell's speech, you know, 40 years later or so. And there are a lot of parallels. There are a lot of parallels, just like Adlai Stevenson was being harassed by constant phone calls from Washington about what to include and what not to. Colin Powell and his aides were getting the exact same treatment before before Colin Powell's speech.
Yeah, there's another. There are a lot of great stories in here, but there's another one here I particularly like that goes back a little bit, and this goes back to the U2 problem between the United States and the Soviet Union. And at that point, the Russians were giving the United States a terrible, terrible time about this. That then you have – and there's a photograph here in the book of at one point when the then-ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, what they did was they brought in a big wooden seal of the United States, which had been presented to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow by the Soviet American Friendship Society. And so they bring this thing in, and Ambassador Lodge sits there and proceeds to demonstrate the fact that this gift from the Russians had been bugged.
Yeah. And this was Henry Cabot Lodge was an ambassador up there for a long time, and he was very effective at kind of dueling with the Soviets. And the Soviets during the U-2 incident, this was in 1960, this was, you know, an American spy plane had been shot down over Soviet territory, and the Soviets thought, aha, this now we'll use the U.N. Security Council as a public theater. And will embarrass the Americans. And so they actually flew in from Moscow one of their top diplomats to make a case. And they thought, you know, they'd be able to score a propaganda coup against the United States. But Henry Cabot Lodge was very skillful at this kind of public dueling. And he did, as you say, brought in this prop and showed the world how the Soviets had bugged this supposed gesture of friendship. Now, of course, that had nothing to do with the U-2 incident, but it was a great distraction. And it was, and again, made for good television. You know, the photographs of him appeared on all the major newspapers. Henry Cabot Lodge was up there for a long time and was, you know, a very effective gladiator from the American standpoint.
Hmm. Another caller here. Well, let's talk with him. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? You're right about it. I was 13 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remember watching the Security Council on television, not really knowing exactly what was going on, but it seemed good theater. But I was going to ask you earlier when you were talking about the fact that people were really interested in the late 40s. It had a lot to do with like middle-aged adults having gone through or knowing about World War One, World War Two, maybe 100 million people died, combatants as well as civilians. So they were just exhausted, I think, psychologically and emotionally over the fact that is there going to be another war with these new nuclear weapons? And so there, the success of the UN is that, because there hasn't been a major confrontation in that at that scale since 1945, and so that would be considered a major success, and that would be a way to talk about this instead of these. Everybody thinks of these peripheral wars, and there are lots of people dying in these small wars, like in Central Africa. And that probably is, I think that's a lot to do with the Security Council on China vetoing anything to do with Sudan because, you know, they get oil and raw materials from Central and Western Africa. And at least this is what I know about it or think I know. But I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, those were very, very perceptive comments. And I totally agree with the caller that it's too easy to kind of avoid or ignore the fact that since 1945 we have had peace between the great powers. You know, and that's easy to take for granted now. And, you know, we can say, oh, the UN's failing in Darfur or it's failing in, you know, different places. But peace between the great powers for more than 60 years is an amazing thing, and particularly in the context of World War One and World War Two. Now, I don't try to argue in the book that this is all because of the Security Council, because the great powers have been talking to each other there. But I do think at the margins, in a number of crises, the Security Council, the mechanism of the Security Council and its consultation has helped, and I try to make that case in the book. I mean, I think there are lots of other factors. Obviously, the fact that the major powers have nuclear weapons now is a huge change, and that just makes them think twice about anything that might lead to conflict. But I do argue in the book that, that at the edges, the Security Council has helped to manage great power relations. I also agree with the callers about China and on Sudan. And this is one of the real frustrations for people who are watching the Security Council operate now, is that on a question like Sudan, where you know, there have been horrible atrocities going on, China has been a fairly strong ally of Sudan on the Security Council. And, you know, when it's had a chance, it's either weakened sanctions against Sudan or prevented more muscular kind of peacekeeping operations. And I think the caller is exactly right. It's because China has lucrative energy deals and weapons deals with Sudan. And also, and this is a broader feature of Security Council diplomacy these days, is that China and Russia don't like the idea of intervention in countries' internal affairs. They don't like the UN doing that, and they often try to block on the Security Council measures that have the flavor of kind of intervening in a country's internal affairs. And you can see why that is, because both Russia and China may have to put down revolts or uprisings, and they don't want the precedent of the international community kind of involving itself in those things.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I want to thank the last caller. Introduce again our guest, David Bosco. He's assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University and is author of a recent book about the UN Security Council. The title of the book is Five to Rule Them All. It's published by the Oxford University Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The numbers if you'd like to call in. Just to talk a little bit more about China. We talked about how at the time, right after World War II, that the Soviet Union, the United States, and the UK, their leaders were talking about the idea of the Security Council, that Franklin Roosevelt really pushed for China to be one of the permanent members. And it clearly was because he thought that China would support the interests of the United States. And at the time, what we were talking about was nationalist China, the Taiwan government. Then in the 70s, that seat, the China seat, passed from Taiwan to the PRC. How did people at the time think that would change things on the council, and did it, in fact, change things very much?
Yeah. There had been a lot of people, particularly in the United States, who had been arguing strongly that that Communist China should never be allowed on the Security Council, that they were too reckless. They were, you know, number one, communist. They were a dictatorship. That they had no place on the Security Council. And when the PRC did finally get its seat, you know, Senator Goldwater and other conservatives gave very kind of blistering speeches in Congress about how this proved the United Nations was useless. And in fact, kind of similar to what our first caller said, you know, Senator Goldwater said we should kick them out of the United States. Why are we hosting this organization? But the truth is that China on the Security Council has been a relatively restrained player, particularly in the first several decades that it was there. It tended to not want to be isolated. It didn't use the veto very often, in contrast to both the Soviet Union and the United States. And it abstained often on resolutions. So it was almost as if China was kind of finding its feet diplomatically, or, you know, operating with training wheels on or something, because in the Security Council they were very cautious for the most part. One of the interesting features, though, of China on the Security Council, and this is in a sense the only way in which China really expressed itself, was that when Communist China got on the Council, relations between them and the Soviet Union were actually terrible at that point. Because by the late 1960s, relations between the Soviets and the Communist Chinese had degenerated, and so one of the, you know, features of Council diplomacy in the early 1970s was that the Soviets and the Chinese would often scream at each other, and in fact, I have a photo in the book of a near fistfight that broke out between the Soviet ambassador and the Chinese ambassador. And for the Americans, this was kind of a nice reprieve, mm-hmm. because the United States had often been on the receiving end of tirades, and now it could kind of sit back and watch the Chinese and the Soviets go at it. So that was a really interesting period in Security Council diplomacy.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left. We have a couple of calls. We'll try to get at least one. Callers will help us by being brief. We'll go to Champaign County. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, I should have started this earlier, but I just, for people's further information, there's a Security Council move, and it's basically sponsored by the U.S. It's called the Responsibility to Protect idea, and it's seen as being, actually remedying the problem with non-action in Darfur and that sort of thing. But there's quite a few really good criticisms of it, that it would be just another way of justifying great powers' humanitarian intervention. And I'll just cite a General Assembly discourse that went that happened in the last days of Miguel de Escoto's presidency at the General Assembly, and it features Noam Chomsky and a guy named Jean Bricmont criticizing the sort of idea of liberal imperialism, I guess one might say. And there's actually links to the presentations by these two gentlemen and two others on the other side at chomsky.info, and it links you to a webcast from the United Nations. So though the regular media isn't covering the United Nations very much, they do have a fairly good process for people who want to spend the time to find out what's really going on. One other note is that contrary to the first caller's sort of characterizing the UN, if you do a reasonable poll of Americans' opinions, actually the UN comes out fairly good, and generally people want the UN to be more active in the U.S. That comes out a little ambiguous too, but thanks a lot. I'm a little feverish today, but I couldn't help but at least make that footnote to the discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, those are first of all, I think that's right on the polling, that there has been fairly strong support in the United States for the idea of the United Nations. But if you ask how effective do you think the United Nations is, people have give it fairly poor marks. Polling in the U.S. does come out, in a somewhat ambiguous way. And I guess that makes sense. They want the UN to be active, but they're very frustrated at how it actually operates. The caller is also quite right to point out this responsibility to protect is an idea that, human rights activists and others have been trying to generate that says basically the international community has a responsibility to intervene in countries when there are massive human rights violations. But as the caller also points out, to a lot of countries, this smacks of imperialism in a sense that, why do the great powers get to intervene when they want to in our affairs? And it's one of the complications of diplomacy at the UN is that, from an American perspective or a Western perspective, we think we're just intervening for humanitarian reasons and that we're impartial and unbiased. But that doesn't look that way often from the developing world's perspective. And so there's a real tension that goes on at the United Nations about this question of intervention.
We just have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you a quick question. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take. I think that for some time people have been talking about the need for reform and enlargement of the Security Council and have argued there should be more permanent seats, and that, as we said earlier, some people have said maybe Brazil should have one. I think for a long time Japan has been arguing, or people have been arguing in behalf of Japan as a permanent seat. Some people say perhaps India should. What do you think of the possibility that such a thing might happen?
Well, I think it's a good idea to get the other major powers in there, because I think that's the value of the Security Council. I think it's going to be a while yet before that happens, because basically, in order to amend the UN Charter, in order to change the Security Council's membership, you need two-thirds of the General Assembly. So essentially, two-thirds of all countries in the world need to agree. And surprise, surprise, the General Assembly cannot agree on how to reform the Security Council, because there's some people who want more permanent seats, some people who want more rotating seats. There's a lot of there are a lot of different plans floating around up in New York. And until the rest of the world can get behind a plan, the current five permanent members are kind of happy to sit back and wait, because they're in a fairly advantageous position.
And I think your argument, and I'm sure other people would argue, that some of the functions that the Security Council serves, that is the opportunity to get people together and for them to talk about things in not in a public way, that function might be undercut or compromised some if you end up making the council a lot bigger.
Yeah, I do worry that, you know, some compromise solution on the council might be to, you know, add a bunch of new members, including more rotating seats, and then you might be at a council of 30 members. And I wonder if at that point it's still going to be a useful place or a comfortable place for great power diplomacy. And if it's not, I think we really have lost something there, and maybe lost the most important thing about the Security Council. So if it's a choice between the current Security Council, which is admittedly outdated, and some kind of bloated new body, which is too big, I guess I'd opt reluctantly for what we've got.
If you would like to read more about the UN Security Council, one place you can go, the book we've talked about, it's titled Five to Rule Them All, The UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. It's published by the Oxford University Press. The author, our guest, David Bosco, he is assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. And Professor Bosco, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.